Welcome to What is Going Om for new thought from the edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgbeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Hello. In his best-selling and award-winning books, Change Your Story, Change Your Life, and Change the Story of Your Health, retired clinical psychologist and Jungian analyst, businessman, shamanic practitioner, author, and philanthropist Carl Greer shared shamanic and Jungian tools to help achieve personal transformation and healing. In his latest book, The Necktie and the Jaguar, a memoir to help you change your story and find fulfillment, Carl Greer shares his own journey of transformation from post-war Midwestern middle-class upbringing tainted by a childhood tragedy that taught him to constrict his emotions to career success and wealth as the president of an independent oil and gas company, to midlife when he recognized that his spiritual self was crying out for nourishment and expression, and what he did to actually transform that story and create a bigger, more fulfilling life for himself. Carl Greer, welcome.
Thank you, Sandy. Nice to be here with you.
Carl, your book, The Necktie and the Jaguar, is an unusual kind of memoir in that, along with intimate details of your life story, you've also taken reader engagement to another level by including thought-provoking questions at the end of each chapter related to the experiences and the insights that you've shared that encourage us to ask questions about our own lives so we too might break through from old patterns and live according to the needs of our soul. So I want to know, was there something particular that inspired you to construct your book that way, or was it just a case of, even in retirement from one's practices as a Jungian analyst, clinical psychologist and shaman, you'll never really stop being a teacher, guide, and practitioner?
Well, probably a little bit of both. In my other two books, I did pose questions for the reader to use to help their process about some of the material in the book. They could journal about it or think about it. So I didn't intend to do that in this book, but after I finished it, I thought, well, you know, maybe there's some of the themes that were up for me in my life. Maybe those themes in similar ways might be up for others, and maybe I could then pose questions that they might wrestle with if they so chose, that might be helpful to them in reflecting on their own journey and maybe making some changes. So that's how it came about.
Well, I've read the other books and we've talked about them on air, and you do kind of expect that kind of thing in a book where you are helping others. But when you're telling your own life story, you know, it's not so common. I actually enjoyed it because it really took me to another place and allowed me to ask some of those questions, which, you know, were quite uncomfortable, you know, about my own life. So, you know, I think it was great that you included them in this as well.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that. You know, it's interesting. I'm a Middle Western raised man, and my hope was that the themes in my life would also be useful for pondering women and people coming from different backgrounds and different geographic locations than I did. So for you to say what you said was, I'm glad to hear that.
Well, I think, you know, the way you, the questions you posed, the experiences you had, I mean, we may not have the same experiences, but we have the same reactions to our experiences. You know, they just, the experience itself, we have the same emotions about the things that happen in life. So really, they are universal.
Yes, yes, that's absolutely true.
Yeah. So your story, like many of our stories, is about seeking meaning and fulfillment in your life and nourishing what you refer to as your mythopoetic self. Tell me what you mean by mythopoetic self.
For me, it's that part of me that has a spiritual component. It's soulful. Isn't practical necessarily, but it's something that I yearn about and yearn for, and had stifled for a lot of my life. And so it was this part that I was seeking that would give me more meaning and a deeper and a different spiritual connection.
You know, I've heard people talk about mythic stories, mythic lives. I've never heard anybody use the word mythic poetic, but I think you've summed it up very well there, because we all do have that yearning inside us. You know, it doesn't matter how successful we are, and you were very successful, still there is that something that, you know, we often say, well, I've got this and I've achieved that ambition, but still I don't feel that, you know, I'm fully there. This, you know, I haven't got to the thing that is really going to give me fulfillment. And I think mythic poetic self is a really good word to describe that.
Well, when I was thinking about what I wanted to do in college, what course to take, I thought I wanted to take a course that would burn out. And even as a, you know, 17, 18-year-old, I had that word mythopoetic come to me somehow. I wanted to burn out that mythopoetic part of me because I didn't think it would be practical. I didn't think it would be helpful for my life. And that's one of the reasons I took engineering, which I wasn't necessarily that crazy about. But I thought it would be practical and give me a good training, but clearly not furthering my desire to explore my mythopoetic side.
Yeah, yeah. In the book, you talk about the importance of service to others. Is that something that was part of your consciousness, even as you were climbing the ladder to become president of the oil and gas company, making hard business decisions designed to increase profitability and success? Or was that something that only began to emerge for you later on, once you really did start listening to the mythic poetic self?
It was the latter. It was when it later on in my life. The first part was more accomplishment, achievement, and I didn't have a lot of time or energy thinking about the other things. But then they became more and more important as I got older and as I made changes in my life.
So tell us how those changes came about and how they impacted you.
In my mid-40s, I decided I wanted to explore an interest that I had years earlier in psychology. So I ended up going back to graduate school, and it took me 8 years, and I got a doctor's degree in clinical psychology. And during that 8 year, I started to see clients. And that process, plus my desire to become a Jungian analyst, led me during those years to go into analysis myself. And I found out a lot of things that I blocked from my consciousness that were getting in my way. So it was a whole personal journey for me to reclaim parts of myself. That was the start of being open to other energies and other types of experiences that I had not had up until that time.
What drew you to Jungian psychology?
I'm sorry?
What drew you to Jungian psychology in particular?
You know, when I wanted to become a psychologist, I wanted to explore what branch of psychology ultimately I wanted to be drawn to. And so I went to some schools around Chicago, Adlerian School, Freudian School, and a Jungian school. And just the Jungians I seemed to have more simpatico with. And I also associated Jungian psychology with stories and books and fairy tales and myths, which I had, as a kid, enjoyed. So it was not necessarily the most rational reasons, but just my feeling I was drawn to that approach to psychology more than the others.
But you, I mean, you spent years and years, I mean, you so wanted to become a Jungian psychologist that you had to go through probably a lot more than you might have done with another type of psychology, surely.
Definitely, because I was still working and, you know, trying to keep all the rest of my life together. It took me 8 years of going to school and seeing clients while I was doing everything else to get my degree in clinical psychology. And then it took me another, 5 years to become a Jungian analyst. So I had 13 years of school and whatnot that were that I had to fit into my life.
So, I mean, that's a long time, and you were still working. I mean, what was it that motivated you? What kept you going through that long slog?
I was really feeding my soul. I mean, the training and whatnot was meaningful to me, and it fed me. And for other reasons, my business life was coming to a close because some of the things I set out to do I'd done, and the circumstances of the industries that I were in had changed. So it was all coming together. I was having more time to explore these things that were important to me.
And you say that today you're amused to remember how very logical you were about starting analysis and how little awareness you had of the need to reflect on your shadow qualities.
Oh yeah, no, I thought this was just another to-do thing. You know, I'd sit in front of somebody, we'd talk, I had no idea what that would look like, and it was just a means to an end. I had no idea that I had lots of parts of myself that had been shut off and blocked and pretty heavily defended that I didn't even want to look at. So it was a very, very valuable process for me, and it took me a while to really own the value. But once I did, then I think I tried to be as aware of what I needed to do as I could be and open to the process.
Yeah, I think most of us kind of, you know, we may say we want change, we want to do something, but once we, you know, start looking at the shadow side of ourselves, we have to go through that. Many of us run away. You know, we don't want to go there. It's too painful. It's too, the ego does not want to be stripped apart.
Absolutely. It's one of the things that I've written about and thought about is if people want to change their life, they have to change their story. But the first step to that is to be really honest about what your story is, and not tell yourself a story that others have told you, or tell yourself the one that you want to hear. And analysis helped me, you know, find out what my true story was.
Mm. Well, we've all got stories, haven't we? I mean, you know, and I think coming to terms with the fact that a story that we've been telling ourselves doesn't work for us is a very, very uncomfortable place to be. Very
it is.
It takes a lot of courage.
Oh, it does. And therefore, we resist owning that and acknowledging it to our detriment, in my opinion.
Yeah. You said that a big discovery was that you needed to work on your relationship to the archetypal feminine energy, your internal unconscious relationship to women. How much of a surprise was that to you? And how comfortable was it doing that work?
Theoretically, it wasn't a surprise because my mother had died when I was relatively young under mysterious circumstances. And I didn't have, you know, much maternal mothering in my life after that. And with the exception of some relatively limited time with one grandmother. So I knew theoretically that I was a little different than a lot in that regard. But the reactions internally that I had to that, you know, affected me in terms of constricting my emotions and my expression of those emotions. And that was more than just a theoretical understanding. That has to kind of get unearthed through the process of analysis and life, layer by layer. And it's painful because it affected in the world the way I related to women and as a father of two daughters, you know, how I was fathering and so forth. So it was a process for me to understand how those events early in my life were affecting me and, you know, later parts of my life.
You share some incredible stories in the book. And of course, when we get to the shamanic part of your journey, then they really move into a whole other dimension, the stories. But just a bit before that, your wife, Pat, there's a very interesting story you tell about when she had breast cancer and you did some visualization work with her. And it wasn't as if it was, you know, you were highly trained in that at that point. It almost reads as if you just, you know, let's give this a go. And you had some incredible results. Would you share that with us?
I had had an interest in shamanism from just kind of a, you know, liking to read the books of Carlos Castaneda and things like that. And coincidentally, and this was in my 40s, maybe late 1980s, I was reading a book by Michael Harner and about shamanism. And I was drawn to some of the practices, and I got some drumming tapes and didgeridoo tapes, and I got a crystal, and I started the journey on my own. So this is just serendipitously happening in my life in the late 1980s. Around the same time, Pat had a lumpectomy and radiation and chemo for breast cancer. And we were on a trip in the Sedona area, and the wound on her breast started to ooze pus and blood. And I just had a instinct, because in the last week I'd been doing some of these practices, that maybe I could do some healing work. And I had this image of me sitting under a tree with a crystal, a woman in a lagoon with a waterfall had a crystal, and then me in Sedona with a crystal. And those crystals all linked up, and I was using that energy with visualizations that I had and Pat had to try to heal what was happening in the wound on her breast. And in a relatively short period of time, less than an hour, the wound healed over, no more bleeding, no more pus. And, you know, who knows what causes what in those realms, Sandy, but it was a very powerful experience, you know, for me and Pat. Subsequent to that, she had another biopsy, and they said that the cancer would come back. And once again, we did some work, and we asked the surgeon who was going to do what they call frozen C-sections to not do the mastectomy without talking to us. And this was me at the time because Pat was under the anesthesia. So he kept coming out. He took several C-sections and could find no cancer. And so she did not have to have the mastectomy and has not had breast cancer return. And that's, you know, many, many years ago.
Was that a huge surprise to you?
Yes, it was, but I was kind of guided to do it, and as I got into the shamanic world subsequently to that, you know, things like that just happen. And so I'm always in awe of the vastness of the world and energies with which we interact. But I'm not, I'm grateful for things like that happening, but I'm not as surprised as I might be had I not been in these realms for a long time.
Yeah. I mean, when you look back on the life you led before you became a psychologist, I mean, when you were president of the oil company, I mean, I would imagine you never even dreamed that you would one day do things like that.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. That was not in my awareness or consciousness.
Do you ever think, my goodness, if I knew how powerful I was, I could have done an awful lot more in that job as president?
I haven't thought about it quite like that. It's funny. I did what I did in my various roles at the time, and had little nudges from within to do things differently. But it wasn't like a real conscious laying out of a roadmap. I kind of got guided, and to my benefit, as I got more comfortable in these unconscious realms, you know, the transpersonal realms of shamans and the unconscious realms of psychology, it kind of freed me up because I found some of the parts of me that had been unconsciously affected to my detriment. I got freed up. I freed up some energy, and I got new insights as to things I might do in the world that I didn't have before. So I think any of the freeing up that I got, rather than put back into business, I think I would have probably, as I did, put them into other aspects of my life, Sandy.
When I look at your story, you know, if I stand back and look at it as a whole, to me, it is a wonderful roadmap. It's almost as if, you know, somebody said, right, I'm going to go down there and I'm going to create this very successful business and I'm going to create wealth and I'm going to then, you know, have the freedom because, you know, wealth does give you freedom to then follow and go along my path and, you know, complete my mission and then use that wealth for tremendous good, which is what you're doing with all your philanthropic work.
And I feel very blessed to have been able to have done that, because as many successful businessmen and women have choices, and one choice is to, you know, lead a different kind of life. Maybe be on some boards and give some money away, and maybe not. But I was called to share that which I had accumulated and try to give back as much of it as I can while I'm alive, and set up processes while I'm no longer around to have it continue to be used for the purposes that I want. And I feel, you know, to whom much is given, much is required, and I'm trying to, in the charities that I'm involved with, which are trying to help those who have gotten the wrong end of the societal stick or economic stick or cultural stick, I'm trying to help even the playing field for them as much as I can. And it feels good to do that. I feel energized even at, you know, past 80 years old to be able to spend time doing those things.
Well, you know, I think there have been studies done on kindness and generosity, and actually the benefits to the person who's being generous and kind are enormous in terms of, you know, physical health, you know, satisfaction, emotional well-being, etc. So, you know, it's something that we should all engage in, what, you know, if we have the means to. But I have a question before we go to break. When you look back over your life, do you feel that there was a pathway laid out, that you can see the dots joining up along the way, that perhaps this was maybe something that you had contracted to do and planned.
I cannot see the dots.
I cannot see the dots.
No, I cannot see the pathway. I just think I kind of muddled through, and but I believe now in hindsight that I was guided in this process, and I had these nudges from how everyone thinks about it, spirit, the unconscious, the collective unconscious, all these realms of mystery. I think I was part of the mystery and had some nudges that got me to where I am right now.
Well, you know, thank goodness you did listen to that guidance. We're going to go to break now, Carl, and when we come back, I really want to focus on some of the shamanic part of your journey, which I think is incredibly fascinating. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and my guest today is retired clinical psychologist, Jungian analyst, businessman, philanthropist, and shamanic practitioner, Carl Greer, author of the best-selling books Change Your Story, Change Your Life, and Change the Story of Your Health. And we're talking about his new book, The Necktie and the Jaguar, a memoir to help you change your story and find...
The future of internet radio is here. OM Times Radio. IOM FM. Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single OM Times endeavor. Host your show with OM Times Radio Network.
Vox Novus, the new voice. Vox Novus, the new dimension. Vox Novus, thought and movement leaders who will share from their experience and offer tools to help us navigate our rapidly changing world. My name is Victor Furman. Join me every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern on OM Times Radio for Vox Novus, the new voice.
Mental health. Most people think it means mental illness. Most people are wrong. Mental health doesn't apply to just some of us. It applies to everyone. We're all susceptible to anxiety and depression. They're human conditions. And no person should ever feel embarrassed, ashamed, or be discriminated against for being human. Cracked the Podcast strips away the shame, fear, and stigma by expanding the conversation into areas less often visited. From brain and body chemistry, hormones, food, nutrition, trauma, and the microbiome, to pharmaceutical drugs, psychedelic substances, meditation, visionary experiences, and spiritual awakenings. Cracked the Podcast will explore them all, including the notion that, for many, breakdown can be the beginning of breakthrough. For in the words of singer-songwriter Leonard Cohen, there is a crack in everything. It's where the light gets in. Cracked the Podcast, slaying the dragons of mental health. Join co-hosts Sandy Sedgbeer and Rebecca Shaper on the first and third Thursday of every month at 12 noon Eastern Time.
COVID-19, brought to you by CDC and the Ad Council.
If you're feeling increasingly lonely right now, you're not alone. It's totally normal. Even though we may not be able to get together in person, connecting virtually with friends and family still gives you a chance to interact with people and may help raise your spirits. Join a virtual book club, set up group text chats, or online video coffee breaks with coworkers.
Find more self-care and coping tips at coping-19.org.
Welcome back. Carl Greer, Chapter 12, The Jaguar's Call. For me, that's where the book really took off. I mean, I enjoyed the rest of it, but I do love playing in the field of possibilities. And that was where you really started playing in those fields. So tell us what prompted, that call.
I had, as a young man, interest in... Native Americans and trappers in the West and that lifestyle. And Then as a man in my 30s, I read books by Castaneda and Teomo Storm and Lynn Andrews and about medicine men and women. So I had that kind of interest. And as I said before the break, I had read Michael Harner's book and was experimenting with certain journey practices. So I had that just as part of my psyche from a relatively young age, but I hadn't really done anything formally with it. Then in my late 50s, almost 60, I read Alberto Viotto's Shaman, Healer, Sage book, and that really interested me. My wife had given me that, and on a vacation down in the Caribbean, I found myself outside in nature and having different kinds of experiences than I'd had for many, many years. Things seemed more alive, and my immersion in it seemed more immersive. And I continued to think about Alberto's book and ended up going to some of his trainings. I completed the basic training and advanced training and became a teacher in his staff. And it became a very important part of my life, relatively late in my life. And since then, it's been a very important part of my spiritual path and evolution.
So in the book, you write about powerful energies in unseen worlds. Can you tell us about some of those experiences?
One of the ideas of shamanism, which is also somewhat akin to ideas in Jungian work, is that we have our conscious ego. We have a personal unconscious, which we repress things in, and we talked earlier about the shadow may be there. And then Jungians say there's a collective unconscious. Shamans may say there's a transpersonal reality that surrounds us and influences us. And shamans may have more manifestations in that realm of animal energies, for example, where Jungians might talk about archetypes and Zeus or Athena or Hera. But it's all personifications of energies that influence how we think, act, and feel. And so shamans would get into an altered state, maybe through drumming or through rattling, and then they would travel to those realms for insights and information, maybe energy, and bring it back to their everyday and hope they can make changes in their everyday life, which is similar to what Jungians would try to do too. We're going to work in the unconscious to try to make changes in our everyday life. So those experiences were available to me through dream work, through shamanic journeys, and in some cases through using the sacred plants. And they gave me insights into realms that I hadn't had before that were sources of energy and change for me that I've hopefully been able to effectuate in my everyday life.
You called that particular chapter the Jaguar's Call. What is the significance of the jaguar in shamanism?
Well, in there are many schools and types of shamanism. I've been initiated into various types of South American shamanism, primarily in the Andes and primarily in Peru. In one of those traditions, the jaguar is an animal of the West, and it has to do with the ability to travel between death and life, the conscious and the unconscious, and in the literal world, the water, you know, it can climb and it can be on the land. So it has the ability to travel different places, but it also it helps mikwi or eat up the heavy energy of the jungle. You know, it eats a lot of animals, and it cleanses and kills so that new life can emerge. So it has metaphorical as well as actual meanings. And for me, it has to do with the mysteries of life and those linkages between life and death, conscious and unconscious.
Yeah, you wrote that, you know, the shamanic work of the West associated with the jaguar is the work of letting go of the fear of death. Why is it so important to let go of the fear of death?
I think for some of us, we're so, we don't have a relationship to death or the energy of death, and we're so afraid of dying that sometimes it's hard for us to live fully. And so if we can develop a relationship with death and see it's an energy like all other energies, and that things have to die in their own time, you don't want to do it prematurely or wait too long, and that's just a timing thing, and realize that sometimes things have to die in order for new life to take hold. And so part of the shamanic work and part of the work I've done is to try to develop for myself and people with whom I've worked a new relationship with death so that death can be an ally. And paradoxically, by having death as an ally, it helps us live more fully and less robotically. So that's how I've thought about the death energy.
It's a paradox, isn't it? I mean, we are afraid of dying, and we don't talk about death in our culture. We don't think about death in the way that maybe it should be thought about. And yet, we're doing it all the time. I mean, we're dying to parts of our lives, you know, circumstances, places, things that we've been interested in all the time.
Oh, yeah, and ourselves die. I mean, you know, our body is dying.
Yeah.
And regenerating all the time until it, in this physical body, stops. And by pondering questions like this, it relativizes, in my opinion, our lives, Sandy. And we are starting to then not just get so immersed in our own stories, but see there's questions like, you know, where were we before we got here? And why are we here? And who are we? And what are we? And where will we be when we're no longer in these bodies? So nobody knows for sure those answers, but just the questions are useful because it does relativize us. Because we all did come from someplace, however you think about that, and we'll be going to someplace, however you think about that. And death is just part of a metaphor that helps us understand those processes, in my opinion.
So you also say that doing the work of the jaguar can even lead us to our destiny. Tell me about that.
The shamanic work, as psychology work, as I see it, Sandy, is designed to help us in the present moment make better decisions than we otherwise would. And the reason that it can do that is it helps us have our past live within us differently than it might because of the work, so that the past doesn't affect us in the present the same way it used to. But the other thing is shamanism can help us get a new destiny path, a path that may be more pleasing to ourselves and to spirit than the one that we're on. And as we learn to not relate to death the way that we have, where the jaguar can help us do that, and where we can learn to be more comfortable with our unconscious, it's easier for us to claim a new destiny, so that that new destiny out there in the future is going to influence what we do in the present. So the work is, by doing the past work, that can be like soul retrievals, for example, we're more present in the present, and by having a new destiny, that will influence what we do in the present. So those two factors make our lives more present in the now than they would be had we not done the work.
When you know, having taken the time to look back over your life and write your memoir, is there anything that you would do differently, any decision you would undo or experience you would change, knowing what you know now? Or do you feel it was all worked out perfectly?
I think the things that I did in the sequence were probably the best I could do at the time. But the way I did them, I wished I would have done a few things differently. I was more impatient than I needed to be. I was more ruled by the clock, trying to crowd things in to my life than I wish I had in hindsight. And I wish I would have, in that vein, taken more time to be a good listener, you know, just to be present, as opposed to always trying to get things done in a on a timeline. So I have regrets in terms of how I did certain things, but not necessarily so much in the actual chapters of my life.
You wrote that it's said that the unseen world can exact a price on those who neglect their spiritual nature. You know, I don't know about other people, but from my perspective, when we feel that yearning, I think that's coming from our spiritual nature. You know, that deeper part of ourselves, the soul, whatever you want to call it. You know, if for people who are feeling that yearning, who feel that they need to make some change in their life to find greater fulfillment, what suggestions do you have for where and how they could start?
I think first honor those yearnings and take time to listen to them. So carve out a little bit of time for yourself to listen to those yearnings. And then if you have a yearning, have a discussion with yourself as to why you can't follow some of those yearnings, and really see what are the impediments that you say are there, and try to process as to whether or not they're really there. And that leads us to a point that I feel is true for many of us. There's part of us that really wants to change, but there's part of us that doesn't. And that part that doesn't want to change to move us towards our spiritual journey needs to be dealt with. And usually it's an unconscious part. And that's where the practices that I talk about in all of my books, you know, how do you access the unconscious and get a glimpse into those things? And that involves working with dreams, which we can all learn to do, shamanic journeying. And a big thing that I have found very helpful, Sandy, is spending time in nature and just letting nature inform us, you know, develop the viewpoint that nature is observing us as we're observing her, and that it has information out there for us for some of these life questions in ways you don't understand. So how in the world can sitting by a brook help me understand a big life decision that I'm trying to make? All I'm saying is that oftentimes it does in ways that we can't even verbalize and understand, but it does. So trust that if you take time for yourself, spend time in nature, that there is a benevolent spirit out there that will work with us.
How can we learn to recognize the stories that we don't even know that we're telling ourselves? I mean, that's an important starting point right there. And it can be a leap.
A big leap. Well, you know, a simple process. I believe there is a place that exists currently, but also existed before creation. I call it the quiet. I've traveled there. I've been there. So it's a place before an idea, the form of the idea, the energization of an idea. It's all pure potential. And I think that place surrounds us now, and that it's possible with our consciousnesses we can interact with it to cause things in this reality that otherwise wouldn't. And if that's so, you can journey to it and communicate with it. And to your question, you know, you can just ask it, you know, what are the things that are keeping me from leading the life that I really feel spiritually I need to live? And wait for that energy to answer you. And amazingly, it often gives an answer to people. Now, the process to set that journey up isn't, you know, cumbersome, but it requires setting an intent and, you know, breathing and changing your, you know, your consciousness a little bit through your breathing and whatnot. But you can have that conversation. And surprisingly, when you start to interact with these realms, there's information there that you can't believe what's going to come up, because it's going to come right from you to you, or from one of these places that can be very useful. So that's one thing that a person can do to overcome what seems to be an impossible situation that they're in, because they just need to get a new perspective on it, and they need to go to a place that has all the answers, which is, in my view, this place called the quiet for me.
Do you think that people can do this and make these kinds of changes and open themselves up, you know, to the spiritual part of themselves and the spiritual realms without taking drugs like, you know, ayahuasca or peyote or something?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, the plant can be helpful, and but also, you know, not helpful if they're not done in the right setting or the right circumstances, the right way. But dream work can be done without plants. Shamanic journeys can be done without plants. Spending meditative time in nature can be done without the plants. So absolutely, there's ways to get your brain waves slower, to go from the fight or flight sympathetic nervous system responses to the parasympathetic nervous system responses. So, you know, the physiology and the neurotransmitters can be changed just through meditation, through rattling, through drumming.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of other ways to get to those states, in my opinion.
Mm. Of all the experiences you've had, and, you know, some of them are really fascinating, is there one that is a kind of, you know, pinnacle experience as far as you're concerned?
I can't say that, really. Maybe a starting experience when I was around 5 years old. We lived in a suburb of Pittsburgh called Mount Lebanon, and I was on my own a lot, and I wandered around a lot. I wandered to a farm at the top of a hill near our house, and I came on that property, and there was an apple tree there, and all of a sudden I just saw, Sandy, kind of like a glow around that tree, and I can remember, you know, right this moment, and I in the tree and the field and the park, I became one. It was a oneness experience that I didn't have for many, many years subsequent to that. I started to reclaim some of those, and after I did some of the shamanic work. But that would maybe be an early reminder that we are part of a larger set of energies. We came from someplace, we'll go to someplace. So in some ways, maybe that was my pinnacle experience.
You see, I see so many dots in your story, Carl. I mean, that experience, you know, you were drawn to Jungian of all the different, you know, forms of psychology with its, you know, emphasis on dreams, etc. And then, the connection to the shamanic part of it, it just looks to me like a brilliant little pathway, very clear.
In hindsight, you know, looking back, I can see that too. But at the time, it didn't seem like I was kind of drawing it. That's, you know, it wasn't a pathway that my ego or my consciousness was kind of laying out. That's where I kind of was like a muddling through, you know, like the fool on the journey, the heroic journey. I kind of, you know, was a blunderer. You know, I blundered into this, blundered into that. And in hindsight, I feel very, very fortunate. I dodged some bullets, and I'm really glad to be where I am in my life now. But I didn't have a lot of conscious planning. I had no master plan.
No, but I bet your soul did. And it was leading you all the way.
Absolutely. I would have to say, in hindsight, yeah. that's that's absolutely, yeah. that had to be true.
Yeah. So what do you most want readers to take away from your book?
It's never too late to make changes in your life. And they don't have to be big changes. And to be of service doesn't mean you have to have a lot of resources, you have to have a lot of money, but you can just do the little acts of kindness, which are great service. Listen to people who you otherwise might not listen to. Just have a consciousness of need and what can you do without taking too much from your own energy that you may or may not have, that to help other people. And you made the point earlier, Sandy, that there's a psychological benefit for many of us to be of service and to give. And I think that's absolutely true. So just try to be available to others, but also start off by spending time with yourself. What can you do for you that might be more pleasing to your soul in what you're doing? And one place you can maybe get answers to that question would be spend more time in nature. You know, be under a tree, be with some flowers, you know, be by some water. Those would be things that I would suggest that people might do.
Yeah, well, and I also think too that, you know, the way you've constructed the questions at the end of each chapter, I mean, that's like having a great course in transformation right there, because you're giving us the questions that we need to ask ourselves in order to actually, you know, create change.
Yes, and I hope people who read the book use them in that way, that it will just be joggers for them to think about, and they can choose or not to choose to, you know, make changes in those areas in their life. But at least they thought about them, and they're posing the possibility of change to themselves.
Mm. So what's next, Carl?
Well, I've dodged some health challenges in the last couple of years. I had open heart surgery a year ago, January, which was successful. I had complete blockages in a lot of arteries in my heart. I just had a course of radiation treatment for prostate cancer, but I'm feeling terrific for a guy soon to be 81, and I want to continue to spend a lot of time with the charities that I'm working with. And I got some more writing that I want to do, and I got lots of kids and grandkids that I want to spend time with, and Pat and I want to do a little traveling. So my agenda is full, Sandy, right now.
Good. Glad to hear it. So it should be. Your life is an inspiration, Carl.
Well, I've been very blessed and very fortunate, but thank you for saying that. Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. It's always a great pleasure to speak with you, Carl.
You as well. I've always enjoyed the time we talked before.
Thank you. Carl Greer, The Necktie and the Jaguar, a memoir to help you change your story and find fulfillment. And I think that's like a twofer there, right there, two for one. Published by Chiron Publications, available from all good bookstores. For more information about Carl Greer, visit his website at www.carlgreer.com. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. You can learn more about me in the No BS Spiritual Book Club at sedgbeer.com, and I'll be back with you for another edition of What Is Going On at the same time next week. Till then, it's goodbye from me.